by law in the first place, and by opinion on many things that are not fit subjects for the operation of law. What these rules should be is the principal question in human affairs. But if we exclude a few of the most obvious cases, it is one of those in which the least progress has been made in resolving. No two ages, and scarcely any two countries, have decided it alike. And the decision of one age or country is a wonder to another. Yet the people of any given age and country no more suspect any difficulty in it than if it were a subject on which humanity had always been agreed. The rules obtained among themselves appear to them self-evident and self-justifying. This all but universal illusion is one of the examples of the magical influence of custom, which is not only, as the proverb says, a second nature, but is continually mistaken as the first. The effect of custom in preventing any misgiving regarding the rules of conduct which human beings impose on one another is all the more complete because the subject is one on which it is not generally considered necessary that reasons should be given, either by one person to others or by each of us to ourselves. People are accustomed to believe, and have been encouraged in the belief by some who aspire to the character of philosophers, that their feelings on subjects of this nature are better than reasons, and render reasons unnecessary. The practical principle that guides them to their opinions on the regulation of human conduct is the feeling that everybody should be required to act as they, and those with whom they sympathize, would like them to act. None of us acknowledge to ourselves that standards of judgment are merely what we like. But an opinion on a point of conduct not supported by reasons can only count as one person's preference. If the reasons, when given, are a mere appeal to a similar preference felt by other people, it is still only many people's liking instead of one. To ordinary people, however, their own preference, thus supported, is not only a perfectly satisfactory reason, but the only one they generally have for any of their notions of morality, taste, or propriety, which are not expressly written in their religious creed, and their chief guide in the interpretation even of that. People's opinions, accordingly, on what is laudable or blamable, are affected by all the multifarious causes which influence their wishes in regard to the conduct of others, and which are as numerous as those that determine their wishes on any other subject. Sometimes it is their reason, at other times their prejudices or superstitions. Often their social affections, not seldom their antisocial ones. Their envy or jealousy, their arrogance or contemptuousness. But most commonly it is their desires or fears for themselves, their legitimate or illegitimate self-interest. Wherever there is an ascendant class, a large portion of the morality of the country emanates from its class interests and its feelings of class superiority. The morality between Spartans and Helots, between plantation owners and slaves, between princes and subjects, between nobles and peasants, and between men and women, has been, for the most part, the creation of these class interests and feelings. The sentiments thus generated react in turn upon the moral feelings of the members of the ascendant class in their relations among themselves. On the other hand, where a formerly ascendant class has lost its ascendancy, or where its ascendancy is unpopular, the prevailing moral sentiments frequently bear the mark of an impatient dislike of superiority. Another grand determining principle of the rules of conduct, both in act and forbearance enforced by law or opinion, has been the servility of people toward the supposed preferences or aversions of their temporal masters or of their gods. This servility, though essentially